The long Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union produced a number of historic moments and situations and names, including the names of people who spied on the United States for the Soviet Union. You may know a couple of these, Aldrich Ames and Robert Hansen among them. There's less chance that you've ever heard of Duncan Chaplin Lee. He, too, spied on a government while working for it. And he's the subject of a new book called A Very Principled Boy, The Life of Duncan Lee, Red Spy and Cold Warrior. Mark A. Bradley is the author of the book. He's a historian, a lawyer, and a Rhodes Scholar. He spent several years working as an intelligence officer for the CIA and is now an attorney in the Federal Justice Department. Mark Bradley, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Your dedication, in part, gives credit to Daniel Patrick Moynihan for giving you the idea. Tell us about that.
That's right. Well, and I worked for the senator. I was his last legislative director. This was toward the end of the 1990s. And we were having lunch one day, and the senator asked me if I'd ever heard of the name Duncan Chaplin Lee. And I said I had not, and he kind of looked at me askance and said, "Well, you all, he reminds me a bit of you." And I thought, what do you mean, Senator? And he said, "Well, you know, you work the CIA. You were both Rhodes Scholars at the same Oxford College. You know, he betrayed his country. You didn't. You might want to look into him." Moynihan had been very instrumental in the mid-90s getting the NSA's Venona program declassified. That was a code-breaking program that we'd started in 1943 against the Soviets, even though we were their allies. We were afraid they would pull out of the war like Lenin had done at the in World War One. And among that program's revelations were about 350 Americans who spied for the Soviets during World War II, and Duncan Lee was one of them.
And then why is he so unknown to us even today?
You know, I think because he got away, and he was kind of lost in the noise. There were so many who were accused, guilty and innocent alike, and Lee was adamant that he was not guilty of these charges, and that he was the victim of political hysteria in the hands of or in the guise of the UAC and McCarthyism, and he was also the victim of a crazed woman, Elizabeth Bentley, who had made the accusations against him. So he mounted a very successful reputational defense.
Well, he does have a point, certainly, with the broader issue of the climate of the times.
Right.
I mean, with HUAC and the McCarthy, the Army McCarthy trials, it was hearings, I should say. Whoops, not trials. As a lawyer, you'd correct me on that if I hadn't.
Yeah.
but there was this, a lot of people could certainly claim to have been swept up in the hysteria.
Absolutely right. There were many, many innocent people who were scooped up, and that's one of the messages of this book. It's very dangerous to politicize national security. I mean, the UAC was handed a bonanza of spying, and instead of having a serious investigation, they launched off in an attempt to discredit Harry Truman and tar the Democrats for the 1948 election. So a golden opportunity was missed, and then by the time Joe McCarthy steps on the scene, the spying's over. But, you know, there are plenty of people who are very suspicious of people who've been accused because of the numbers that have been accused in the late 1940s. So he was able to build on that and you know, launched, you know, unfortunately, a fairly successful career at it.
So Duncan Lee actually lived to a pretty ripe old age and died in the late 80s, didn't he?
He died in 1988 in Toronto, Canada.
And so did we not know until after his death, the evidence that confirmed what he'd been up to?
The FBI and what became the National Security Agency knew as early, certainly by the late 40s or very early 1950s, that he had done what Elizabeth Bentley had said he had done. The problem was proving it. Lee, unlike Alger Hiss, never gave the Soviets any documents. He memorized what he told them. So he was not... didn't have the problem that Hiss had with Whitaker Chambers and the so-called pumpkin papers when you know, Hiss said, "This is a lie." And Chambers said, "Well, look, let me show you something." And then he produced these documents in Alger Hiss's handwriting. Again, we had broken the Soviet codes, but we didn't want the Soviets to know that we had broken their codes. We weren't going to use that evidence in court. In fact, it would have been very difficult at that time to have gotten the stuff into evidence even if we had been so inclined, but we were not. Remember, the Venona program goes from 1943 until 1980. So this is very much an ongoing program when the proof about Lee's guilt surfaces.
So the technique he used, though, where he would memorize the documents and then you point out this interchange very early in the book, and then get with his handler, his Soviet handler, and repeat to this person what this, and then go back over and over again. It's almost like practicing a play. Was that a fairly standard technique for making sure that you were not caught red-handed?
Well, it was certainly a very smart technique. Now, other spies did give documents, but you know, Lee, he was a very, very smart man, and he was trying to minimize, his personal risks. And so, he certainly practiced it, and to his enormous benefit. I mean, I think it may well have saved his life.
Duncan Lee is the person we're talking about. The book on him is called The Very Principled Boy, The Life of Duncan Lee, a Red Spy and Cold Warrior. You've just gotten a taste of a very fascinating story about a very fascinating man, and a very complicated one as well. Mark Bradley wrote the book. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We will come back in a few moments and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Your questions and comments welcome. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Mark A. Bradley and you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Mark Bradley. He is the author of a book about a spy you never heard of, Duncan Lee, Red Spy and Cold Warrior. The book on him is called The Very Principled Boy. You can join the discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we've given the basic picture here that Duncan Lee denied through his lifetime that he had done anything. The evidence came in after he died.
Right.
Let's talk about his origins, Mark. Where is he from? I mean, how far did his roots go back in North America?
Well, they went very far. Lee was a direct descendant of Richard Henry Lee, one of the two Lee brothers who signed the Declaration of Independence. So he was a member of the famed Lee family of Virginia. He was also a collateral relative of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Duncan's great-grandfather was Robert E. Lee's first cousin. From his mother, he was descended from John Priscilla Alden of the Mayflower. So he was all-American on both sides.
Well, no kidding. That's some pedigree, yeah.
Indeed it is. And he was born, Duncan Lee himself was born in China in 1913. He was the son of missionaries. And he spent his formative years until he was 14 in China.
And so his father appears to have been a very influential character on young Duncan. Tell us about the impact and the ongoing effect on his life.
It was enormous. Edmund Jennings Lee IV was Duncan's father. He was a missionary in China from 1902 until 1928. And Duncan always said, my father was a mystic. And by that, Duncan said, if there's any man who could speak directly with God, it was my father. Lee was in awe of his father because of that. And he was also in awe of his father because of the expectations that his father and mother put on him. They told him from a very young age that a selfish life would not do, that he had to find his own way, as they had, to serve mankind, to serve something greater than themselves. A comfortable material life would not do. And so, he spent his youth and also his early manhood searching for that pathway. And I argue in the book that he found it through communism.
Did the amount of the world that he got to see as a child really broaden his horizons a lot and make him think less, perhaps, like a more provincial American?
That's a very interesting observation. I think that Lee would have, and of course he never admitted anything, but if he had, I think he would have told you his loyalty was to mankind, not to a nation or to a people. So yes, I think it did in a very forcible way affect his outlook on that and on loyalty.
And you pointed out already he was a Rhodes Scholar, certainly a very good student at a very early age. I'm struck by his use of the term proletariat in his coursework at such a young age.
Yeah, He was extremely academically gifted, but that didn't set him apart. I mean, you know, the Cambridge Five, you know, the famous British spy ring of, you know, Kim Philby, Donald McLean, Guy Burgess, Anthony Blutt, John Cairncross, were also exceptional students. Alger Hiss himself, Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Johns Hopkins, editor of the Harvard Law Review, Supreme Court secretary. You know, these were very, very gifted people, at least in the academic sense.
Truly that. And obviously, it matters not just the where Duncan Lee was in his life, but the when in his life. For example,
Indeed.
He went to Yale University, but when in history was he at Yale? What was going on around him at that time?
He was at Yale from 1931 until 1935. And, of course, what happens is, when he's at Yale, the Great Depression, it reaches its low point in American life. By the time he enters Yale, about 25% of the American workforce has been idled. Also, too, during those years, you begin to hear the stomp of the fascist jackboots, especially in Italy and in Germany and in Japan. And so, you know, he's coming of age at a time when it appears that capitalism is crumbling, and also that fascism is on the march. And so it is a very volatile time to be coming of age, particularly if you're searching for a cause.
Interesting. So he saw capitalism as not necessarily viable anymore. He rejected the two major things that were out there and went for the one that was a little less obvious, certainly for somebody in North America.
Indeed. Indeed. I mean, by the time he joins the Communist Party in 1939, there are about 100,000 Americans who are members of the party. So it's always, you know, historically, even at high tide, was extremely small. So it was an unusual choice to make, but he wasn't alone. There were many, many American intellectuals and also British intellectuals who followed the same path, because only the Soviets seemed to have addressed economic want, and also the Soviets were standing up to fascists, particularly in Spain.
And it also seems like young Duncan Lee was also very suspicious of big power structures, which he found in the corporate world and certainly found in fascism.
He was. Was. He had a deep distrust for those types of institutions, although, as you point out, he certainly joined them.
Mark Bradley is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is A Very Principled Boy, The Life of Duncan Lee, Red Spy and Cold Warrior. Here is John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mark Bradley.
Hi.
Well,
I guess the same thing happened to the Russians, and I want to know if you had any stories about some of the coups that we pulled off. I'll give you an example. I know the number two guy in the KGB came over to us sometime, I think, in the 80s. Then there was a book written called Blind Man's Bluff, where American subs had found this communications cable that ran from Vladivostok off to somewhere.
Right.
We tapped into it for years, and nobody ever knew about it.
That's correct.
And so I was just curious if you have any stories about us cooing them.
Well, you know,
thanks.
Thank you, John.
I appreciate the call. You know, I'm still, you know, my job today is in national security, so I don't talk about much about what we're doing now or even what we've done over the last years. But John's absolutely right. I mean, our spy services, in addition to the Soviets, or I don't call them Soviets anymore, the Russians, I mean, still spend a lot of money and time trying to penetrate each other. I mean, that's part of the reason why these services exist, is to be able to get very good human intelligence. And so it's still a very active game that's being played on both sides, and frankly on almost all sides.
Back to Duncan Lee himself, then. I mean, you point out again, he's a Rhodes Scholar like yourself. He says he learned how to think at Yale, but he learned what to think at Oxford. What did he mean by that?
Well, by that, you know, there was no evidence in his letters at Yale that he was on the road to communism. He was certainly searching for something. But, you know, Yale, you know, was remarkably insulated from a lot of the destruction of the Great Depression. I mean, you get the sense from his letters that, although he was certainly aware of it, it didn't impact his life all that much. That changed when he got to Oxford. Oxford's a different place entirely. It was still recovering from having its gut shot out in World War I. And so you have a real, I think, rebellion against the Edwardian ideas that had led England into the war and led to the Holocaust of the what was later to be called the missing generation. The losses at Oxford and Cambridge were just absolutely deplorable. If you were an Oxford junior officer in World War I, you had a five times greater chance of being killed than the men that you led, because you were expected to lead from the front. You were expected to set an example. So you had this type of real disillusion with leadership, British leadership. Also, too, the Great Depression had slammed in England much harder than it had here in the United States. About one-third of the British people by the time Lee is at Oxford are beneath the poverty line. Another third are barely above it. But you have another third that's living quite well, and that third is represented by the Oxbridge classes, Oxford and Cambridge. So you have what I call a climate of guilt set in, that how can it be that we are living so well, and how is it that we survived the war but our fathers and brothers did not? And so, I mean, is it right for us to be, you know, enjoying this type of life without making some type of sacrifices? So, you know, Oxford's almost a perfect petri dish for Lee. Because remember, in 1933, there had been that famous Oxford proclamation at the Oxford Union, which said, you know, this house will not fight for king and country. That's a tremendously important statement to have made, because what you have is you have the sons of the ruling classes saying, you know what, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to defend the realm. So when he goes up to Oxford in 1935, the place is electrically charged. Also, too, by that time, the Communist Party has gotten a pretty strong foothold in the city. And, you know, roughly probably about somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 or so Oxford students are members of the party when Lee arrives. So, you know, it's completely different from the environment he experienced at Yale.
We're talking about Duncan Lee, a Red Spy and Cold Warrior profiled in the book A Very Principled Boy by our guest Mark Bradley. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. The whole idea of these people saying in 1933, we will not fight for king and country, was astonishing in itself, particularly in the context of how England felt 10 years later and less. But it begs the question about Duncan Lee. I mean, certainly we've indicated his feelings about capitalism failing,
right,
and producing the Great Depression. Not a fan of fascism either. Could he separate out capitalism and the American political system? Did he think there was something wrong with the American political system too, or did he just sort of lump it all together?
You know, I think that he thought it was inadequate to meet the challenges that the country was facing. And that's, you know, it's ironic, because by the time he goes up to Oxford, I mean, you've got Franklin Roosevelt in the White House, and of course the New Deal is underway, and it's not exactly like, you know, the American government's not trying to address the upheaval that the Depression has caused. But, you know, I think that he thought it was still too anemic and still too weak to be able to address what he saw coming. Now, remember, 1936, he took two trips to Nazi Germany. And what he saw there terrified him. He saw that Hitler actually was going to do what he had been saying he was going to do. It wasn't just empty rhetoric, that he was actually going to set fascism loose in Europe. And again, I mean, you know, it's very hard when you write history to transport yourself back to that time. But, you know, the fear in his letters was palpable. And, you know, he was terrified that the Nazis were going to do exactly what they said they were going to do. And, you know, he was very prescient about that.
The whole idea of not being able to transport yourself back to that time brings up an excellent point. When you think about people joining the Communist Party, as Duncan did in 1939, it seems something that is just impossible to conceive in today's terms. But that's because here we are sitting after the Cold War.
Correct.
There was no Cold War yet.
Correct.
And so this was just seen as an alternative and a viable alternative for, as you pointed out, 100,000 people.
Extremely viable. Now, again, you know, Lee took a trip to Russia in 1937, and he was still in Oxford. He was in his third year. And his first postcard back to his parents just had the words scribbled across it, you know, perfectly unbelievable. And what he said was, I've seen the utopia. I've seen the Soviet experiment, and it works. Now, what's interesting about that is by 1937, of course, Stalin has started his purges, and they're in full swing. And although nobody can give you an exact figure, somewhere in the neighborhood of 750,000 of his own citizens were executed. Another 750,000 were probably transported to gulags. So it's a very odd time for one to have that reaction. But if you look at these trips that people such as Lee took, they were very carefully shepherded. They were shown exactly what they were supposed to see. They weren't exposed to the maw, the killing machinery. You know, you saw the treasures of the Soviet people, the Hermitage. You saw the Kremlin. You know, you went to Lenin's house. You had a very genteel trip, and so, you know, it's interesting to see somebody so smart be so, I guess, bamboozled by what he saw. But again, he wasn't alone. In 1932, the New York Times won a Pulitzer Prize for claiming that Stalin's famines were not true.
Wow.
Well, he wasn't alone.
Well, and it really was a Potemkin Village kind of trip where he just
Indeed.
Got to see the best of everything. And it's like going to the best parts of the shopping mall and not seeing where the trash gets thrown out. You mentioned that he sent a postcard back to his parents describing this place as a utopia. And I just wonder what the parental reaction was, because he did come to a break with his parents, a more pronounced one later on.
But they were completely horrified. The Soviets had no use for religion. You know, I mean, and so by choosing communism over over the heritage he had had, the religious heritage he had, I mean, it produced a real shockwave among his family. You know, his mother and father were probably weak tea socialists. They had supported Norman Thomas in 1932, but they were miles away from being communist, again because of the communist stand on religion, and also too. His parents were very concerned that Lee would be throwing away his brilliant future. That even though communism didn't yet have the stigma it was to have in the 50s, in the 30s it still was not extremely popular among the great mass of Americans. And so they worried about Duncan's destroying his future, his brilliant future.
Duncan Lee's the subject matter. Mark Bradley, the author of a book about him called The Very Principled Boy, here on the Jefferson Exchange. Haven't asked about Ishbel yet, and how lefty she was in comparison to both Duncan and to the general strain of thinking of the day.
Well, Ishbel was Duncan's first wife. He was married twice. She was a daughter of the British Raj. She'd been born in India. Her father was a tax collector. And she was absolutely appalled by the British Empire. I mean, she had a very, I think, uneasy childhood growing up and watching the Raj as it was functioning in India. She felt very much alienated and thought that the Raj served no purpose but to increase the wealth of England, and that was it, much to the detriment of the Indians. When she came to Oxford in 1932, she... the last thing she wanted was to support the British Empire. And she became enmeshed in the university's left-wing politics, and I think played an extraordinarily powerful role in Duncan's life. In a way, she became a kind of a surrogate parent for him in terms of influence. I mean, she, I think if he had not met her, whether or not he would have become a spy, I think would have been a very close question. I her influence was almost... completely dominant. Now, again, he, I think, was prepared for her to come into his life in the sense that he was looking for a great cause. And if you were a caring, and this may sound strange again, you know, in 2014, but if, you know, you were coming of age in the 1930s and had witnessed the degradations of the Great Depression and had witnessed the stomp of the fascist jackboots, that communism seemed not only a viable alternative, but perhaps even a correct one.
The thing that I've always had a hard time trying to figure out, though, is how closely connected were the Communist Party of the USA and the Communist Party in the Soviet Union?
Right. Well, you know, they were extremely closely connected. I mean, they were run by the American Communist Party, was run by the Comintern out of Moscow, and it got a lot of its funding out of Moscow. In fact, Moscow Gold kept the party alive during its very lean years during the 1920s after the first Red Scare. You know, the first Red Scare was about 1919 to 1922. The party was driven underground. And also, too, you know, the American Communist Party had a very strong relationship with the Soviet intelligence services. And that became particularly true as World War II neared, because Stalin, as part of his purges, had liquidated some of his best intelligence officers. Between 19, 1937 and 1939, we estimate that he executed probably about 20,000 of his best NKVD officers.
Wow, so he needed more people, more eyes, more ears all over the world. And Duncan Lee was certainly willing to do that. We'll hear more about a very principled boy, Mark Bradley, the writer, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Back with Mark, and we'll take your phone calls and emails as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Mark Bradley. He's a former intelligence officer for the CIA, now an attorney in the Federal Justice Department, himself a historian, lawyer, and Rhodes Scholar. Duncan Lee himself was a Rhodes Scholar. He is the subject matter of Mark Bradley's book, A Very Principled Boy, The Life of Duncan Lee, Red Spy and Cold Warrior. Never went to prison, did Duncan Lee? We're finding out why. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you have questions or comments about this or the general interaction of the United States and Soviet Union during the Cold War. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. The mind reels a bit when we think about Duncan Lee and the jobs he had and just his general outlook on life, in the sense that here's an American who really believes in the Soviet system. He's a Wall Street lawyer planning the end of capitalism, as you point out. This is right. I really wonder how his head was able to contain all these thoughts.
Well, you know, the best spies are the ones who can compartmentalize the best. They almost are able to segregate their lives into nice, discrete portions. And Lee was a master at that. And, you know, it's funny because when I was writing the book, it was almost as if I were writing about different people at different times of his life, as if the early Lee had nothing to do with the later Lee. And so he was extraordinarily adept at being able to wall himself off his different lives. Now, he wasn't alone. I mean, Alger Hiss did the exact same thing. I mean, he was able to work for a Wall Street firm, too. And you know, you can work for Wall Street in the day and then dream of collectivizing its wealth at night. I mean, that's what the, you know, spies do. They live double lives. So he was extraordinarily gifted at that.
So what was the COI and how did it get started?
Well, it was the Coordinator of Information. You know, as we were, meaning the United States, was slowly being, I don't want to say dragged into World War II, but certainly being nudged into it, Franklin Roosevelt realized that we needed intelligence. We didn't have any. That sounds almost absurd now when you consider how many different agencies we have out there that collect and analyze intelligence. But before the war, we had a very small, we had no Central Intelligence Service. The Army had one, the Navy had one, Treasury Department had a small one, the FBI had a very, very small one. And so the idea was is that somebody had to be able to collect all the information that we did have and be able to analyze it and then disseminate it to get it out. And so in 1941, Franklin Roosevelt turned to his old Columbia Law School classmate, William J. Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, and asked him to become the first coordinator of information.
Which, you know, here again, the mind reels because it seems like we're still talking about the same sort of thing today. When we came up with the Director of National Intelligence, we were trying to find somebody like the Coordinator of Information who could pull all the stuff together from different agencies.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, it's funny how repetitive American history can be.
All right, we'll leave it at that. Let's take some calls here. We have Mark and Redding on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mark Bradley, the author of A Very Principled Boy.
Good morning.
Hi, Mark.
Did Lee accept money?
No.
For his spying?
He did not. He did it strictly for ideological reasons, which
really
makes him unique. I mean, most of the post-World War II spies, many of them have been motivated by money, but Lee was strictly ideology.
All right. And Mark, did you have a follow-up?
Well, I don't believe that Lee is unique in not getting caught, because I believe there was one man that was known to have worked with the Rosenbergs and never was arrested, tried, and convicted.
You're absolutely right. Lee was not unique. In fact, out of most of the people that Elizabeth Bentley named, very, very few were brought to justice. In fact, only two went to prison, and not for espionage.
And then Mark, thanks for that, Mark in Reading. I have to believe then that the lack of a paper trail or receipts or extra money in the bank account was probably one of the things that made it hard to connect Duncan Lee definitively for years.
It did. Now, you know, it's interesting too when you're transporting yourself back to time. I mean, we have a very different FBI back then than we have now too, and the Bureau was. I think between 1924 and 1936 opened one espionage case. And so, you know, it was mostly a cops and robbers type of agency back then. And remember, they spent most of their time in the late 30s chasing John Dillinger and Pretty Boy Floyd and that group. And coming up against the NKVD was a totally different experience for them. And it took them... some years to be able to match the Soviets.
Two dots I still need to connect here, which is Duncan Lee and the COI and how he ended up working for Wild Bill Donovan.
Right. Well, Donovan, of course, was the principal partner of the law firm that Lee went to work for in 1939. And Lee had the perfect background for somebody like Donovan. Donovan, you know, was an Irish-American, although he had gone to Columbia for undergraduate in law school, still had this fascination with the upper classes. And Lee's background, of course, was tailor-made for that. Lee of Virginia, Yale, Oxford, Rhodes Scholar, all that. And they formed a very close personal relationship. And Donovan, when he was asked to stand up this new agency, was doing it from scratch. It had to be done very quickly. And as what most of us do, you reach back to the people that you have experience with and that you trust the most. And so when the agency was, when COI became the Office of Strategic Services in 1942, it became much, much bigger and a much stronger agency. Donovan asked several in his law firm to join him. And, of course, one of his favorites was Duncan Lee. So he took Lee in as one of his top aides. And also, too, Lee in 1943 became head of what was called the Secretariat, which was the OSS's nerve center. So every cable coming into Donovan and going out from Donovan, Lee saw and had access to.
He was right there then, at the right-hand man of the guy on the top.
He couldn't have had a better position.
Which raises the question about the rudimentary nature of background checks at the time. Did nobody ask or have access to information about the Communist Party?
I mean, now when you have a top-secret clearance, compartmentalized clearance, you have, the FBI goes back to one's 18th birthday. And you have neighborhood checks, you have all sorts of very detailed employment checks, school checks, all that. Lee's background investigation lasted for 8 days, and it was very, very, very quick. One of the reasons why it was quick was not only, again, we have no experience in doing background checks, but also, too, it was very clear to the investigators that Donovan wanted Lee. And, you know, if the head of the agency wants you, then, you know, God help you if you're standing in the way of that. So it was a very, I want to say peremptory, but it was a pretty awfully, awfully quick quick investigation. It was done by the Civil Service Commission.
Ah, okay. So not people who are really good police investigators or anything along those lines.
No.
You mentioned in the book that there are old jokes about the close relationship between sex and spying. Well, what did get Lee in with the Soviets?
Well, he was recruited right after he agreed to join the OSS, and he was recruited by a woman named Mary Price. Mary Price was from North Carolina, had gone to University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, had grown up as a poor farmer's daughter in rural North Carolina, and had become enraged as a child watching the exploitative cycle of Southern farming. You had sharecroppers and tenant farmers and growers and this. And so she became radicalized at a young age. And while after finishing up at Chapel Hill, she went to Moscow in 1936 on a trip. While there, she was recruited by the Soviets to become a spy. And one of her first jobs was to be secretary to Walter Lippmann. Lippmann in those days was, of course, the great American opinion maker. He was a leading newspaper columnist. And Lee was introduced to her through Mary's sister, Mildred. Lee, when he was at Donovan's firm, did some pro bono work for an agency called China Aid Council, which was a communist front. And Mildred thought that Lee could be an up-and-comer, and she knew that Mary needed sources, and so she put the two together. Almost immediately, the two Southerners were attracted to one another, and then they began a sexual relationship not long after that, which is something you don't do in the intelligence world. You're not supposed to sleep with your agents. I mean, it can blur objectivity. And so, you know, I argue in the book that sex played a role in why he was recruited, but it wasn't. I think that he realized himself that, you know, when Donovan asked him to join the OSS, that his great moment had come. He had been given a unique opportunity. Because remember, by that time, June 22nd, 1941, Hitler had invaded the Soviet Union. And, you know, I'm going to give you some astonishing figures, but there's something that you know, are worth thinking about. During World War II, the Soviets lost about 27 million people. About 11 million of those died on the battlefield. We lost about 406,000. For every five German soldiers killed in World War II, the Soviets killed four. It was absolutely critical for our security to keep the Soviets into the war. You have this great irony of, you know, Stalin's, who's vowed to overthrow capitalism, he winds up in an odd way helping save it. And so, you know, what Lee would have told you is that it was, you know, he was actually, you know, protecting the United States by helping the Soviets. Now, of course, this is looked at totally differently by 1946 or 1947, when the Soviets are no longer our gallant allies, but now our implacable enemies.
And you did mention Elizabeth Bentley several times here, the so-called Red Spy Queen. There was a connection between them. I mean, they knew each other pretty well, it sounds
like. There were. She became Lee's second handler and her most important. Soviets were very disappointed in the information that Lee was giving Mary Price, and they thought that perhaps it could be that Price wasn't up to it, so they needed a more seasoned handler. So they pushed Price aside and asked Bentley to step in. And they were together from, oh gosh, you know, off and on from 1942 until late 1944. And she not only became his main handler, but later his main accuser. She defected to the FBI in November of 1945.
And this is an FBI that still, of course, has J. Edgar Hoover in charge. And so you can just imagine the torch that lit under him.
Well, it's staggering because he had no idea that there were at least two major espionage rings operating in Washington. Hoover saw communism as an ideological threat back then, not as an espionage threat. And he was particularly concerned about the influence of communism on African Americans. And you know, it's astonishing, writing reports to the White House about communism influence on blacks in Washington, while in the same city the Soviets are stealing about every secret we've got.
Yeah, that is that's pretty amazing. So obviously Hoover suspected that Duncan Lee was working for the Soviets. Didn't the FBI get that?
Well,
idea?
They did when Bentley told them.
Yeah.
And they stayed on Lee for another 13 years, but they were never able to catch him. He was always one step ahead.
That's uncanny. That's amazing.
Right.
But a lot of it had to do with the fact that his methods for transmitting information had nothing to do with paperwork other than what passed in front of his own
that's
eyes,
right.
And then he then remembered.
That's right. That's exactly right. And then, of course, you know, he tried to help himself by becoming a cold warrior in China after the war.
Huh. It's interesting to put all these parts of history together again. I mean, well, just to think in terms of the way that Duncan Lee was looking at helping the Soviets to save capitalism. I mean, the
yes.
fact is that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so for the Soviets were our friends as long as there was a Hitler.
That's correct.
And then once Hitler was out of the way, all of a sudden the Soviets were our enemies.
That's exactly right. And what Lee had done then, I mean, what he had done in 1943 looked treasonous, you know. but you know, again, it was critical. Even FDR realized how critical it was. Well, in fact, he realized it from the get-go that it was absolutely essential that Russians stay in the war because he knew that we weren't ready. It would take some time for the American industrial might and our military. At the beginning of the war, our army's the 18th smallest in the world. Belgium has a bigger military than we have. We are not ready to fight World War II. But as long as the Soviets are tying up the German army, remember, they tie up the over two-thirds of the German army throughout most of the war.
Mm-hmm.
It's critical that Hitler, you know, stays embroiled on the Eastern Front. And remember, we don't get to France until June of 1944.
Right. And there's a long shadow that you cast here from the activities of Duncan Lee and the investigations of it here. I mean, you talk about Hoover's efforts leading to the McCarthy era activities, but also having an effect on American politics for decades.
That's right. I mean, one of the depressing things that comes out of this period of time is that, you know, McCarthy is very successful at bullying the Democrats into thinking they can never again be weak on national security. And it's ironic to me. I mean, certainly, that you look at the Democrats fought Korea. They fought most of Vietnam. They won World War II, and yet somehow they're the party that's been weak on national security. But that's American history for you.
Indeed. We have just barely skirted the circumstances of Duncan Lee's life. It's a very interesting book. It's called The Very Principled Boy, The Life of Duncan Lee, Red Spy and Cold Warrior. Mark Bradley wrote it, and he joined us today in The Exchange. Mark, thanks.
No, the pleasure has been mine.
All right, take care.
Okay.
That'll do it for today's Exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. We do provide show topics and recordings on our Facebook page as well. The same links are available on Twitter, at Jeff Exchange. If you're listening in the morning, the takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, we'll be followed by news from the BBC. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll get an update from the Oregon Department of Forestry about fires going on around the region. The big one, of course, the Moccasin Hill Fire in the Sprague River area. At 8:30, we'll talk about sexual assault on college campus and proper approaches to that. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the people behind another effort to get Oregon to legalize recreational marijuana, potentially on November's ballot. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duran. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.